pals o' mine. What do you think of those cake postcards? I know they've been around for a little while, but I'm still on the fence. It's a creative idea, but it's kind of weird and almost mean. Hey, here's a slice of cake you can't eat. Love you. Stone frogs are cool, though. This show is sponsored by Mike Kahn of Stone Frog Media. Mike is the guy to call when you need help with your website or marketing done quickly and efficiently. StoneFrogMedia.com. So I read a couple books recently. The first was Traveling Sprinkler by Nicholson Baker. Imagine reading something like this. I sat in my car and closed the door. I turned the key in the ignition and the car started up. I put the car into reverse and backed out of my driveway. But I stopped at the end of the driveway to look in both directions to make sure no cars were behind me. Riveting, isn't it? That's the entire book in a nutshell. He wrote on and on about bassoons and threw in musical references to try and be hip, I suppose, but the book was sawdust dry. I hung in there till the end, hoping something interesting would happen, but it was not to be. There were, however, some nicely turned phrases, such as, "Very fine clouds have, without my noticing, moved across the moon and collected around it like the soft gray dust in the dryer." When at the car wash, he wrote, "I put quarters in the jukebox of emptiness and vacuumed the sand out of the passenger side. A wall of dense brown cigars and boxes, looking like old leather-bound books of unread sermons in a historic house in the Yorkshire moors." Talking about a water fountain, he wrote, "There was usually some flesh-colored gum lying like a tiny naked baby Jesus in the drain." If you actually enjoy endless talk of bassoons, then this is your book. Otherwise, I'd suggest passing on this one. Then I read Tom Perrott's The Wishbones, which was awarded Notable Book of the Year by both the New York Times and American Library Association. The back cover's synopsis reads, "Everything was going pretty well for Dave Raymond. He was 31, but he still felt young. He was playing guitar with the Wishbones, a New Jersey wedding band, $200 for a four-hour gig. And while it wasn't exactly the big time, it was music. He had a roof over his head. Well, it was his parents' roof, but they didn't hassle him much. And he had the comfortable company of his fellow Wishbones. Lazy hours spent downing beers and quizzing each other on rock and roll trivia. Life wasn't perfect, but it wasn't bad. Not bad at all. Then he had to blow it all by proposing to his girlfriend." It's dialogue heavy, so it's a fairly quick read. Unlike The Traveling Sprinkler, you enjoy the musical reference bits and pieces. In fact, there's an interesting and unique suggestion for a Broadway musical. I don't want to spoil it for you. Again, it's The Wishbones by Tom Perrotta, Perrotta. Now, if you are an aspiring writer, you may find the Hemingway app useful. You copy and paste sections of your manuscript into a text editor, and the app's algorithm analyzes the formation of sentences, how many adverbs have been used, number of times a passive voice has been used, and the simplicity of word choices. Of course, Hemingway's style was short and concise, and that may not necessarily be your style, but it may still provide a different perspective for you. That's HemingwayApp.com. As you know, this past Monday, a potentially dangerous asteroid safely flew by Earth. But it was interesting to rewatch the videos of the one that flew over Russia last year. injuring over 1,000 residents due to flying glass, especially knowing it wasn't a movie special effects. The asteroid was so large and intense, it was easily caught on webcams. It's cool how observatories can zoom in on stars, planets, and asteroids millions of miles away. The rest of us, without telescopes, have to settle for distant stars, the moon, clouds, lightning, fog, and smog. Smog. Did you know the first time the term smog was used was back in 1905? In fact, most of that famous London fog was actually smog. In 1873, 500 people died from it. In December 1952, the so-called Great London Smog lasted 5 days and resulted in 4,000 deaths. 4 years later, the government passed its first Clean Air Act. Meanwhile, in the U.S., the first air pollution control district was established in Los Angeles in 1947. I'm bringing this up because of our crazy change in weather patterns. The majority of scientists around the world agree that it's due to climate change. Some aspects are natural planetary shifts, but others are due to man-made pollution. Of course, there is the small, head-in-the-sand demographic who doesn't want to believe that the fact of climate change even exists. Personally, it's been my experience that the more informed you are, the better equipped you are to either acclimate or work on solutions. I just wanted a few actual facts about what is currently being done and what I can actually do. So, I went to the top. Bart Crows, chief of the research division at the California Air Resources Board. He holds both a Bachelor of Science and Master of Science in Chemical Engineering. He was the program manager for the 1997 Southern California Ozone Study and Aerosol Program, and former manager of Atmospheric Processes, Particulate Matter, and Acid Deposition Research at the California Air Resources Board. So one question I just wanted to get out of the way is, does air pollution have a major impact on climate change?
I think there's no doubt about that. The rise in temperatures for the last century is unprecedented. Over about the last million years, it seems to correlate really well with carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gas levels in the atmosphere, the warming of the oceans, the warming of the atmosphere is what you would expect from the amount of gases. It's something we're observing in our lifetimes now. We see glaciers melting. We've observed sea level rise here in California for the last 100 years. People that live in Sacramento have probably noticed how few foggy days we have and how much nighttime temperatures have increased. So the science has settled. Basically, every scientific organization in the world has reached the same conclusion.
And yet people are still debating it. Is that just the creationists or just people who don't want to accept the fact that it's occurring?
Well, I think it's important to recognize that there's a large industry of climate deniers that are funded by some of the major energy companies. And if you look, I think there's some legitimate scientists that have expressed doubts, but I think the majority of them that you see on the blogosphere and talking on the radio, you know, if you look at their source of funding, it's usually linked back to energy companies. And the vast majority of scientists, well over 95%, that have seriously studied this issue, reached the conclusion that most of the warming that we've observed since the Industrial Revolution is due to man-made emissions.
Because obviously the planet has its natural changes on its own, but man has raised the bar insofar as some of those changes.
Right. There's natural cycles of warming and cooling. Certainly the glaciers have melted before and the oceans have risen, and you can link that back to changes in the orbit of the Earth. But this period of unprecedented rapid warming that we've seen really has no other explanation other than man-made emissions.
Right, it's the rate that it's occurring.
Right.
Which is alarming. Now, we can't go back in time and you can't erase what's already been done, but there are ways that you can at least stabilize it, would you say?
Yeah, so the collective effort around the world is to present what we call catastrophic tipping points, where you have, you know, melting of the Greenland ice sheet or the Antarctic ice sheet or changes in the circulation of the ocean that would just lead to, you know, several yards of sea level rise or change weather systems and make it, you know, difficult to grow in some regions. And so what we're trying to do is prevent that. And the level that scientists have identified is preventing a 2 degree centigrade rise or almost 4 degree Fahrenheit rise since the Industrial Revolution. Temperatures have risen almost to half of that level, on the order of 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit. What we're really trying to do is prevent, by the end of this century, it going to this level of 2 degrees centigrade or 4 degrees Fahrenheit. In order to achieve that, all countries would need to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions by about 80%. So California has taken the first step in that. We're reducing our emissions back to 1990 levels by 2020. So that's about a 30% reduction.
So you have been able to go back in time and reverse.
Yeah, well, it's
some aspect.
You know, we're about 1.5% of global greenhouse gas emissions. So if only we're doing something, then it's, you know, we're going to get overwhelmed by growth in China and India and the rest of the developing world. So it's really going to take joint action. And, you know, we've seen that occurring in Japan and Europe. Even seems like even China is starting to take it seriously.
I've seen the photos of China. Like, holy crap.
Well, yes, they have two issues in China. One is air pollution. So the visible haze that's responsible for things like premature death in adults or delayed growth in your lungs in children. That's a very serious problem in China right now that they're trying to address, and actually very similar to what we experienced here in Los Angeles just after World War II during the economic boom during that period. Air pollution is one problem, and the other is the greenhouse gases, which are mostly invisible. China has overtaken the U.S. as the largest single emitter of greenhouse gases. But it's important to recognize, you know, China has 4 to 5 times as many people as we do, so their carbon footprint is a lot less than ours. But as China, India, and other countries drive toward having, you know, as many cars per capita as we do, then, you know, it's just going to be a very large increase there. But finally, China is starting to pay attention to things like fuel economy standards that we in Europe and other developed countries are taking on.
Is there a specific type of vehicle that China seems to have a tendency to purchase more than others that are similar to the U.S. or different?
Actually, the car fleet in China, especially in the richer cities like Beijing and Shanghai, are pretty similar to a modern fleet here. You know, they want the same big, powerful cars that we like. But, you know, you can have the same size car with the same acceleration, the same look and feel to it, but that reduces the amount of fuel it consumes by half. So that's something we've implemented here in California and the rest of the United States, is the average fuel economy of the vehicle sold today is about 25 miles per gallon. But by 2025, the average car needs to be 55 miles per gallon. You know, just a few years ago, it was in the low 20s. So fuel economy has actually increased quite a bit here in California, United States. And, you know, you basically have the same cars available for purchase. They're a little bit more expensive. You put about, you know, $5,000 to $1,000 more technology on that vehicle, but you're going to save $5,000 to $6,000 a year in fuel cost. And, you know, we're pushing the fuel economy even higher. So you'll see more availability of electric vehicles, things that you can charge at home for very cheaply. See more hybrid vehicles that give you the range of a gasoline vehicle, but some of the advantages of a vehicle. And we're seeing more efficient engines now in the vehicle. So again, they perform the same in terms of acceleration, but they have much better fuel economy with very little incremental cost.
Now, are garages, mechanics keeping up with these changes? Or are you going to be limited at first to where you can take it in when you have problems?
No, the engines are pretty understandable, though the gasoline engines are evolving into more performing like a diesel engine, but you know, that's a technology, that's a simple technology. It's actually been around for a long time. And then there's things like better aerodynamic, more efficient air conditioning systems, more efficient transmission systems. So, and you know, the other thing we've done is we've extended the warranty period for the emission control systems past 150,000 miles. So even if you have problems, it'll be the responsibility of the...
That's a big factor, 150.
Right.
Some of us reach there pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned children in China. I mean, even children over here, their diet, especially if they don't eat well to begin with, and now they're breathing crap, you know, and it's hard to get out of old habits. You know, is there something around the house, at least, that can consumers can do on a daily basis, change their lifestyle somewhat?
Indoor air pollution is something we've been studying now for about 20 years. And, you know, we've done some things to reduce the air pollution in your house. You know, recognize that people are now spending up to 90% of their day in the house, children even more. You know, if you consider where you work, where you go to school, where you live, in your vehicle, that's where you spend most of your time. So we've done things like reduce formaldehyde emissions from the glue that's used in compressed woods, plywoods. So that's actually penetrated the market. And so you'll have just less emissions in your house. I've personally taken the carpet out of my house and put in wood floors, because not only does a carpet give off formaldehyde emissions, which is a carcinogen and a lung and eye irritant, but it also kind of holds things like pesticides and other toxic materials get tracked into the house and then releases them over time, where with a wood floor can sweep those up. The other thing I've done in our house is installed a good stove fan. So most stove fans are pretty ineffective, or they're too noisy. People just don't use them. So we got a quiet, effective model. Make sure that it's on anytime we're using our gas range. I think those are the main things that you can do at your house.
And those are pretty simple, too.
More benign place, that's right.
We were talking about China earlier. Have you actually traveled to China and spoken with some of the government there private organizations about?
Yes, I've traveled several times to China. One time to create a program to measure air pollution, which is something that's now done in every major city there. They also brought me over in 2007 to describe what Los Angeles had done to reduce the impact of air pollution on the 1984 Olympics. So LA did things like move deliveries to the nighttime or early morning, so it didn't add to the traffic burden. A lot of industries just reduced their activity during that time period. So there's generally lower traffic, lower industrial activity, which is something that China copied during the 2008 Olympics. And it seems to have been successful, where air pollution wasn't as big a problem during the Olympics as it could have been. And I think what's happening now in China is what we saw happen in Los Angeles, is people in the city realize that you could actually reduce air pollution levels quite significantly with things that really didn't disrupt their lives very much. And so that's something they really demanded to occur on a permanent basis. So you see now in China that they're actually taking very seriously cleaning up some of the smokestack industries and getting cleaner cars into their fleet. They're also doing things like bringing natural gas into use for heating and cooking, where they've used coal in the past. And I expect that they'll probably take 5 or 10 years to accomplish what it took us 20 or 30 and have a significant reduction in their air pollution
levels. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
When they get focused, they get focused.
Yeah, they do. That happens when you have such a strong central government. Yeah, it's hard to understate how bad air pollution was in Los Angeles. Basically, almost every day of the year was unhealthy to sensitive individuals. And one out of every 3 days was unhealthy to the general population, where you shouldn't be outside exercising. And levels have been reduced between 80 and 95% for every air pollutant, so that there's no of these extreme unhealthy days anymore in Los Angeles. And, you know, there's on the order of, 50 of the 75 unhealthy days. But these unhealthy time periods are confined to a much smaller area than in the past. So there's been this dramatic improvement that, you know, if you were a lifelong resident of LA, you would see in increased visibility. And I think it's just amazing what's been accomplished there.
It is pretty impressive.
And even places here like Sacramento or San Francisco, which you would expect to be pretty clean because of the constant sea breezes, even those were extremely dirty back in the 50s and 60s. You know, when people used to burn their garbage in the open, you know, we used to burn all the rice straw fields here in Sacramento, which is not allowed anymore, only limited to days when the winds are favorable. Yeah, it's just been pretty dramatic cleanup. And I think it's had very little disruption of the economy. Basically, don't regulate air pollution if we think it's going to have a pretty negative effect on the economy. And so what we've seen, you know, our fuel costs and our car costs are slightly higher, but that's been offset by reduced hospitalizations and asthma attacks. And new industries have been created. So the people that develop, manufacture, and install the clean technologies have created lots of jobs, hundreds of thousands of jobs here in California that have offset some of those costs. So there's been pretty minimal impact on the economy in terms of cost and a lot of benefits in terms of reduced illness and disease and improved quality of life.
Do you think it made a difference when Nixon lowered the speed limit to 55 and in an attempt to lower some of the air pollution?
Certainly, it's hard to drive on Highway 80 or 50 today and believe that speed limits have been reduced. But the cars actually operate more efficiently. They have kind of a sweet spot at 40 to 60 miles per hour. If your car is idling or at a low speed or a very high speed, it puts more pollution. So yeah, I think reducing speed limits not only saves lives and reduce accidents, but probably has a lower pollution footprint.
So even though they raised it back up to 65, have you seen any market difference? Or
no, I think, you know, our philosophy has been to, at the Air Resources Board, has been to set performance standard for cars, trucks, and fuels. And basically what comes out of the tailpipe today of a car is 1% of what used to be back in the early 60s from a diesel engine. What comes out of the tailpipe is only 2% of what it used to be. What we've done is we offset a lot of growth in the number of people that live in California, the number of vehicles that they own, the number of miles that they drive. And so I think speed limits is a fairly moderate perturbation in, you know, all the growth that's occurred.
I think it's more the start, stop that we have
right
inside and, you know, in town and on the freeway that really goes crazy. California has set standards. Are there other states that come to mind that you've noticed have pressed change in their numbers in pollution?
So California has this unique authority that we can set cleaner regulations for cars, trucks, and fuels than what the federal government sets. So we're the only state that has that ability to set different limits.
Huh.
And other states are allowed to copy our limits. And what we've seen is that all the states in the Northeast, Oregon and Washington generally copy what we do. And all these states represent about 30% of the car market. So what the car manufacturers do is they basically aren't going to create one car for California and the states that adopt our regulations and a different set of cars for the rest of the country. So generally what we do start here in California gets copied across the U.S. It generally becomes a new national standard. And so the entire country benefits. We basically first demonstrate here, and then eventually these regulations have now underway to Europe, Japan, and even a lot of developing worlds. We've estimated that over 75% of the new cars sold today around the world use technologies that were first demonstrated here.
Good for us. So is there anything on the horizon that people should pay attention to that maybe isn't covered in the news so much? It's kind of up on the horizon, maybe aren't completed yet, certain projects, but are in the works that you and your fellow research scientists are excited about, that have great potential.
Well, I think a few things have come out that I think could benefit people in their everyday life. As we've reduced outdoor air pollution, you know, we found that people are spending more time indoors, including in their cars. So, you know, our commutes have become a lot longer, and basically on the most polluted part of the city when we're on a roadway. So we've been doing some studies to see what impact that has on your health. And average Californian spends about an hour and a half on the road. That hour and a half accounts for 30 to 50% of your total air pollution exposure during the day. So what we have found that if you close your windows, turn your vent to recirculate, especially if you have some of the newer cars with filters, that you can greatly reduce your air pollution. So that's something we recommend that people do. Another thing what we're trying to do is, or give people information on how they can reduce their energy bills, which reduces greenhouse gas emissions, which, you know, helps cool the planet. So we've developed some tools on our website called coolcalifornia.org that allows you to calculate your carbon footprint from your energy bill, from your transportation, from the food you eat, from the goods and services you buy, and then gives you an interactive tool that allows you to calculate what you could do to reduce that energy use and those associated greenhouse gas emissions. Done some of that in this house that I'm remodeling. And for instance, we find that if you use an incandescent light bulb, you're spending about $3 a year to turn that on. If you go to a compact fluorescent, you're only going to spend $2 a year on that light fixture. And if you go to an LED, you're only spending $1 a year. So what we've found is that utilities are subsidizing LEDs. And so if you can find an LED for $5, it's going to pay itself back in 2 years, especially since they last so much longer than the other two types of light bulbs. Your refrigerator, I think, is another great example of where you can really reduce your energy cost. So a new refrigerator today is bigger than refrigerators sold in the 70s. You know, it has a lot more features like automatic ice makers, automatic defrosters. That refrigerator is much bigger today. The only thing that limits the size of it is what you can fit through your door. But a new refrigerator today uses 1/5 of the energy of a refrigerator before California started doing energy standards back in the mid-70s. And if you consider the inflation, that refrigerator actually costs less today than it used to. So I think upgrading your appliances, if you have really old ones, can pay for itself very quickly in reduced energy bills.
And utility companies, at least out here, will actually pay you to come pick it up.
Right, yes.
So check in your area to see if they have that.
Right. Yeah, there's a lot of great programs that the utilities have. It used to be they would have an incentive to, you know, the more energy people use, the more profit they would make. But in California, profits have been decoupled from sales. So they're actually being provided incentives to reduce energy usage and make more profit that way. So that's why there's a lot of great programs like that now.
Well, that's how you do it, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you can still make a lot of money, just do it this way instead of that way.
Governments place sensors in certain areas to gather data on air particulates. But what if there was also citizen data? In other words, a way for you and me to check air quality in our own neighborhoods? A device that we could plug into an outside wall of our homes, which would take regular readings and send that data wirelessly to a base station inside. We could discover pockets in neighborhoods where it's more heavily concentrated and pass it on to the appropriate officials so they could be in an even better informed position in planning strategies. Also, communities would learn more about what is causing concentrated unhealthy air quality near their homes and discover what they could do to change patterns to improve it. It seems to be heading our way. Designers, technologists, developers, architects, students, and artists in an international community effort have developed the Air Quality Egg to achieve this very goal. Check it out, airqualityegg.com. In my ongoing tribute to the 150th anniversary of the National Park System, this week I'm heading over to Wind Cave in the southern Black Hills of South Dakota, which was established as a national park in 1903. In fact, it was the first cave in the world to be established as a national park. The park is comprised of 33,851 acres. The wind that travels through the entrance of the wind cave will actually change directions depending on the atmospheric pressure between the entrance and the surface. Local tribes consider the cave sacred. Although there are Native American tribal legends surrounding the wind cave, white men naturally viewed it as a money-making venture and ended up in a legal battle with each other as to who exactly owned the cave. But fortunately, that ended upon the park's inclusion in the national park system. In 1912, a national game preserve was established bordering Wind Cave, where it was agreed to reestablish a bison herd per the American Bison Society. 14 bison came from the New York Zoological Society. 21 elk arrived from Wyoming, and Alberta, Canada sent 13 pronghorn. The park is now home to 500 bison. What's the difference between bison and buffalo? I'm glad you asked. The difference is that the two main species of buffalo actually reside in Africa and Asia. What we have in the USA are bison, which have the large shoulder hump. Early American settlers mistook them for buffalo, and the error stuck. 14 bison were killed in the park last year due to motor vehicle accidents. Slow down, people. Back to Wind Cave. There is a 4-hour ranger-guided tour, which includes a lot of crawling. If that invokes a little cringing, as it would for me, tours of other caves are available. By the way, you may have also heard in the news that the first federally registered historic vehicle is the 1964 Shelby Cobra Daytona Coupe. The National Park Service, which administers the heritage documentation programs, worked with the Historic Vehicle Association to define what criteria an automobile must meet to be listed on the Historic American Engineering Record, and also began putting together a list of eligible vehicles with the association. Another reason to celebrate the National Park Service. Do something different. Record sounds of your favorite place for your ringtone. Mountain birds or creeks. Your neighborhood bar. Ocean waves. Nightclub. Coffee house. Ball games.